Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Glad to have you with us for the show today. Especially happy to have the panel that we have in here. This is one of those days when I could just say hello to everybody and then leave the studio and you can all do the show. Absolutely. Greg Bluestein, it's Wednesday. We always love having you here on Wednesdays, although because Galloway's on vacation, we get the pleasure of having you here all week. Greg, of course, the lead political writer, reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He's been covering the governor's race inside and out and a lot of other political stories as well. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. This is our fun time. This is our Super Bowl.
So. Yeah, that's exactly right. Covering the last few weeks of a race is always the most fun of all. And we got a lot to talk about in that race today. Loretta Lepore is here. She is a Republican consultant. She was the press secretary to Governor Sonny Perdue when he held that office, and was the co-chair of Carly Fiorina's presidential campaign in Georgia. And, you know, I talk about you as a Republican strategist, Loretta, but what you really have become is a government affairs person who covers, you work on a lot of interesting issues, transportation being one of the biggest.
Right, I do. I've done a lot of transportation work as well as work with the technology and healthcare industries.
Okay, and we once again have paired off Sam Olens, former attorney general, former chairman of the Cobb County Commission, former president of Kennesaw State University, with Michael Thurman, former state labor secretary, former member of the Georgia House of Representatives, former school superintendent of DeKalb County, and now the CEO of DeKalb County. I love it when you two come in. Thank you to you, Mike, and to you, Sam.
Oh, delighted to be with you and Sam and the audience, of course.
All right. By the way, if you're keeping track or if you have the TV on, with our sound up, England scored in the first 4.5 minutes of their match against Croatia. It is 1-0 in their semifinal match in the World Cup. Bluestein, who you have in that?
England.
Yeah, they're ahead 1-0. All right, let's talk politics. Greg, you predicted on Monday that we've just come to the end of a fundraising disclosure period, and you predicted on the show on Monday that it was likely we were going to set a new record when the numbers all came in. In fact, that's what happened. Tell us about what you've learned.
Yeah, we've soared way past $30 million in that race, and there's still 4 months to go. We have $33 million just in the governor's race alone. We probably, all told, are kind of maybe close to $40, $45 million for all the political races up and down the ticket. It's a tremendous amount of money being spent. And we had Casey Cagle leading the pack with more than $10.5 million raised since he got in the race last year. He has about $1.3 million-ish left in the bank. And Stacey Abrams is just restocking. She has the most cash on hand because she doesn't have to worry about a runoff. And she's been raising a lot of small dollar donations. The bulk of her money is raised from out of state, but also a tremendous amount of it is from $25, $50, $20.18. She has a lot of $20.18 donations. So she's using the stockpile for November.
So, by the way, I forgot to mention, and before we continue it, look, you can watch us on Facebook Live. Just go to the GPB News page on Facebook. All right, so everybody, weigh in on this. We know that Cagle has a big money advantage. Brian Kemp is well behind, but he has reserved about $1 million. He's already put $1 million into a TV campaign later in the race. How much will money determine the outcome of this runoff? I toss it up to anybody who wants to answer. Who wants to go first? Sam?
So, look, if this race was decided by money, the latest polls wouldn't be a point apart. So, by definition, Cagle has spent a lot more money, but the polls don't show value for that spend.
Okay. So then what does, Sam, if it's not spending, in a runoff election like this, what does make the difference?
It's all turnout.
Well, so, yeah, but what drives people to the polls?
Well, passion. You know, let's face it, Brian has always been stronger with grassroots. Mm-hmm. Casey has always been stronger with the business community. And it's all a function of, you know, there's been a really good, healthy, early voter turnout. What I haven't seen and I'd love to see is that coming from throughout the whole state, only part of the state? If you see a lot of these votes are coming from South Georgia, that's going to bode very well for Brian.
Well, I agree, obviously, with what Sam said. I think if you look at the disclosures, you can, you know, see what Sam says bear out, where you see a lot of the so-called establishment or folks that work typically under the Gold Dome have contributed heavily to Casey Cagle's campaign. Brian Kemp's campaign has more small-dollar donations, more statewide type contributions. And if you look at the expenditures, Brian Kemp has more expenditures going to grassroots operations. And that's very clear if you're comparing the two. So it is going to be about passion. It is going to be who is the turnout voter in a runoff in the middle of July. And that's typically your high propensity Republican voters. And, if you've ever been to a Republican state convention, you know that Brian is always there in force. His team is always there in force. So he's had a longstanding relationship with the grassroots elements of the party. Casey's, been building that and obviously has tremendous name ID, having served so many years in the legislature and as lieutenant governor.
Mike, I like this notion that Sam Olin suggested, which is passion has a lot to do with who votes. And it seems that the passion is with the Kemp folks because he's built his campaign more around ideology, I think, than Cagle. Is that a fair assumption?
Well, yes, but first, let me state from the Democratic side, we are really enjoying this runoff to no end. But in a more serious note, I've been struck, the money, but by the harshness of the advertising. These guys don't like each other. I mean, they really don't. And you have to fight to win. But up and down the ballot, even at the lieutenant governor's race, the insurance commissioner, I sat last night, and that just, to me, was somewhat unique in terms of the attacks, the harshness of the attacks. And I think that might make it much more difficult to really build a coalition necessary in November, which I'm sure, and myself included, Democrats are looking forward to.
You're right about that. I mean, this is a grudge match, and you've got both campaigns now calling for federal prosecutions into the other candidate. So that just says it all. But the passion is there, too. I mean, I joined Brian Kemp's. He's in the middle of a bus tour, a statewide bus tour, and I joined them yesterday. And this was a kind of a lunch, not a regular scheduled meeting, just a lunch featuring Brian Kemp at a little agricultural hall in the middle of Carrollton. And 150 people showed up for barbecue lunch, and packed, probably more than 150 people, and packed this room to hear Brian Kemp speak and to hear the Secretary of State of Alabama was the only other major speaker. And then they lined up for 45 minutes afterwards to take selfies with him. That is a lot of grassroots enthusiasm, and those are the people who will be voting on July 24th, and most of that room had already voted.
It reminds me of Mark Taylor, Kathy Cox, where the Democrat Party didn't recover from the nastiness of the
primary. This was a Democratic primary campaign. Democratic runoff. Well, right, runoff, yeah. Primary runoff campaign election between the then lieutenant governor, the then Secretary of State, Taylor, and Kathy Cox.
Go ahead. And it was so negative that, Sonny just walked through at that point.
Well, absolutely. And on a looking, in a broader way at this campaign, I remember, I guess it was 6 or 7 weeks ago, we were all here, even prior to the primary, and we were talking about Kemp and the fact that he was really in, quote, the catbird seat going in. And one of the things we talked about, even when Casey had a huge lead in the polls, is not to underestimate Kemp. He comes from a political family that's well-connected, tremendous amount of capital, and he is the most Trump-like. Let's just be clear. In a Republican primary, if you had to pick the candidate that's most like Donald Trump, it would be Brian Kemp. How that plays out in November is another story. But in a runoff in July, in Georgia, that could be to his advantage. I'm also wondering about the Purdue's. That's something I've talked about with Jim Galloway. There's an expectation that Governor Deal will endorse Casey. What I'm really waiting for is where will Senator Perdue and Secretary Perdue, what side will they come in on? because that brings President Trump into play.
Well, you worked for him, Loretta. You worked for Sonny Perdue. He's not going to get involved as Secretary of Agriculture, but is David Perdue likely to weigh in a runoff situation? Is Mike Thurmond just trying to stir up trouble here?
He's always stirring up trouble. I really candidly don't think David Perdue is going to enter the fray in this runoff. I think he has personal considerations, for future if he seeks future office in just 2 years. And because the race is so close, to let the citizens or the voters decide this, I think is going to be the more prudent way that both Governor Perdue, former Governor Perdue, Secretary Perdue, and Senator Perdue go. I mean, we're looking at a very small group of undecided voters. And those voters that are committed to Casey Cagle and those voters that are committed to Brian Kemp are very committed to them. We're not going to see them at some point kind of switch over unless something, catastrophic occurred on either side. But this essentially, like in the latest poll that we've seen publicly, 9% of potential voters in this runoff that are undecided. That's a small group.
Sure is. Greg?
Yeah, for everything I've heard, President Trump, Senator Perdue, and Senator Isaacson are staying out of the race. But Governor Deal is a different story. And I just posted a story a few minutes ago on AJC, myajc.com, about a meeting that Governor Deal had up in Gainesville a few Fridays ago with Lieutenant Governor Cagle and all the sort of Gainesville brain trust, where he didn't formally endorse Cagle, but he said essentially, if you want Gainesville to continue to be the center of the political universe here in Georgia, you better support Casey.
All right. Let's get into some real specifics with the election coming ever closer to us. Casey Cagle has a brand new TV commercial out. And it's notable, Greg. We're going to play the audio from that spot in a minute. It's notable because he's trying to, it seems, fill that void, the energy that Kemp showed in his primary commercials, that get tough spirit, trying to rouse himself in a more enthusiastic way about the race. Is there anything we need to know before we listen to this spot?
It was definitely a different side of Casey Cagle than we've seen, and this shows him kind of stomping around stage, swinging his arms. And also keep in mind, the Kemp people are saying this is his Howard Dean moment, so keep that in mind as you listen to the audio.
Let's listen to the new Casey Cagle spot.
Dirty tricks and fake news are what we've come to expect, but leadership is about getting things done for you. I'll never apologize for stopping those that stand in the way of conservative school reform for our kids or cutting taxes that create jobs. I'll never apologize for outlawing sanctuary cities or stopping liberals from taking the values that make our country great. The time for conservatives getting kicked around is over.
Sam Olin's Casey Cagle sounds like he's having one of the Brian Kemp, I just said that, moments in this spot.
Well, look, when you've got the audio coming out from the meeting with Clay Tippins, that's clearly part of the theory to get past that moment. The whole idea that he was also referencing his opponents rather than his view of the Republican Party. This is all how he tries to get past that moment.
Okay. Anybody else want to weigh in on that? Okay. So let's listen then to how Brian Kemp is responding by conjuring up the secret tape, the Clay Tippins tape, which reveals Casey Cagle saying, I didn't like the bill, but I voted for it because I knew it was good for my politics.
I'm Brian Kemp. Casey Cagle is falsely attacking because he has to. You've heard the tapes. Cagle admitted that he thought a new state law was bad policy for Georgia, but it could mean millions to his campaign. So Cagle passed it anyway. Well, if that's not criminal, it should be. I'm Brian Kemp. As governor, I'll fight for what's right to make Georgia proud every day.
Greg, you reported that Kemp is letting the commercial talk about that secret recording, but out on the campaign trail, he isn't. That isn't the message that he's getting out, right?
Yeah, he's talking about on the campaign trail his policies, and he really does. He says this a lot, and he really believes it. I think that he has more policy out there on his website than any of the candidates in this race, including Stacey Abrams. And so he's talking about his spending plan and spending cap, all that. But no, this campaign commercial says it pretty bluntly, and it's the first time where he's really seized on the recording, because his first campaign commercial kind of hinted towards what he called the corruption scandal, but didn't really invoke this. Now he's going all in.
Loretta, it's going to be interesting. It is interesting to hear Greg say that Kemp is talking policy on the campaign trail, because the policy positions of the candidates are not getting a lot of attention, including, I have to say, on this show. And maybe in the weeks ahead before the election, we've got to spend more time on that.
Absolutely. And I, you know, I'm hopeful that in the debate even this week that there's more focus on policy in the primary debate that was hosted by the Atlanta Press Club and GPB, really focused on two core issues: guns, immigration. We know where they stand on this, right? And there's very little light between the two of them. So what are the other issues that can be discussed? And I think that's one of the key things they have to get across in front of a broader audience that are going to be critical during the debate. If you're looking at Brian Kemp's social media platform, there's much more policy coming out in emails, less about the politics, more about the policy. I think yesterday I got one on adoption policy. I've gotten one on school choice. You know, that's more of what's coming out. It's an aggressive campaign. I think what's interesting about these two broadcast commercials is that they're kind of flipping in tone, where Casey Cagle came out in the campaign initially as a very measured policy guy. All of his commercials were about different aspects of policy, in particular education. And now he's going at the very guttural, more emotional, trying to drive some passion, to Sam's point. And Brian is taking a little more of a restrained tone. He doesn't have any chainsaws in this latest ad. You know, he doesn't have a big truck in it. But he's making some very strategic points about it. And so it's interesting to see the transition. If you're looking out there at what's going on at the campaign trail, and you're looking, to Greg's point, you know, on social media, if you're tracking that, where most of the grassroots does, you're seeing a lot of energy behind Brian's campaign. And when you're at this point in races, any race, just like in a Peachtree Road race, you're looking slightly over your shoulder at what the other guy or gal is doing. And that's where these campaigns are. And if they're seeing all the energy behind Brian's campaign, you've got people hailing his bus on the road, asking for signs. You've got his daughters out there. We're seeing that there's an uptick in young women for his campaign, probably because his daughters and his wife have been out every single day. They're relatable to them. So it's just a very interesting dynamic as we go into these final 2 weeks.
Sam and Michael, you are both veterans of many election campaigns. Mike, let me start with you. Policy. Can you really wage a campaign on policy out there, or is it, in fact, the back and forth on issues like a secret tape, in this case, that end up energizing the campaign and voters?
It's what you said and what we said earlier. In a runoff, it's about getting your supporters to the polls. It's not really about convincing, because this is a small number of people who are yet to be unconvinced. It's, can you get your supporters in a significant way back to the polls at a critical point in time? That's what the runoff is about. Now, I believe there are macro influences, too. I wouldn't want to be an establishment Republican or Democrat on the ballot right now, because there is a movement afoot in this country where quote-unquote establishment candidates are struggling. And the broader writ story behind Kemp versus Cagle is the revolution that's taking place in the Republican Party. There's an old biblical saying, you sow the wind, you reap the whirlwind. The whirlwind is being brought to bear in this primary and across this country, not just with Republicans, but also with Democrats. People are disaffected and angry and frustrated with the status quo. Whether that status quo is Republican or Democrat, it doesn't matter.
Sam?
Well, I agree with the doctor. I think by definition, it's all about getting people to the polls. It would be my hope that as we get closer to November, we could actually discuss education, because I think that's really the biggest issue facing our state in the future. But at this point, as Mike said, it's all about getting folks to the polls.
All right, let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, I want to do one more thing around the gubernatorial race, the GOP runoff race. But we're really pressing the time that we've got to get a break in. When we come back, let's just talk briefly about a kind of an ugly episode, Greg Bluestein, that involves State Senator Renee Unterman and a key staffer for Brian Kemp's campaign. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Peter Sagal here, and if you're in your car, I want you to try something. Roll up the windows, you're all sealed inside, take a good smell. Can you smell that? That was the great cologne experiment of 2004. You should not have gone with the dollar store for that one. Well, you can lose that old car smell by donating your vehicle to one of your favorite causes, like public radio. It only takes a few minutes, and just like that, you've supported this station, and well, you are on your way to a life of better smells.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
Greg Bluestein, several days ago, a number of Casey Cagle's top supporters kind of got out a similar message, which was they believe that there ought to be a criminal investigation of Brian Kemp taking contributions from entities that he regulates. I got that part of it right, yes?
Mm-hmm.
One of the people who made that comment was Senator Renee Unterman, Gwinnett County state senator, and Ryan Mahoney, who he was one of the key staffers over there on the Kemp campaign, made a took a real swipe at her. He said what?
Yeah, he said that she was mentally unstable and that she needed to watch herself before she did harm to others or herself.
Oh, to get back on her meds.
Yeah.
And you know, we talked about this briefly on Monday, Greg, because we said this feels like the impact of Donald Trump's politics on a state race where anything goes, where taking this kind of slap at an opponent is perfectly acceptable.
And we talked just now earlier about how nasty this race has gotten. This is like example 1A. And Cagle responded directly to that, calling that a sexist attack. And now we have a very lengthy and emotional Facebook message from Renee Unterman on her personal Facebook account, where she detailed in great length her family struggles and her own struggles with mental illness and depression, and her son's suicide. To that we still haven't had a response from the Kemp campaign, but this just shows you how emotional and personal this battle has become within the Republican Party.
She, in that Facebook post, among other things, says, "So Brian Kemp, who wants to become our state leader, you can make fun of me and belittle those who have had or will have mental illness, but you won't shut me up for speaking out. I won't be intimidated, blackmailed, belittled, or sexually harassed into being quiet. I will always speak out for the little person, the underdog, and the disadvantaged." You know, I have to acknowledge something here, Loretta. When we talked about this on Monday, I didn't think of this as I thought it was an outrageous kind of attack. Mm-hmm. It didn't occur to me that it was a sexist attack. Todd Rehm, one of our frequent panelists, sent me a text saying this is sexist. He doesn't believe that men would be accused of being mentally unstable. What do you make of that?
I don't follow that line, really.
Okay.
I don't think it's a sexist attack. My concern is more on the nature of the mental illness in general being commented on. You know, I do a lot of my philanthropic work in the mental health community. So it struck me, it struck my nerves when it was stated. And so I think there are a lot of vulnerable people in our society right now. And so for that reason, I thought it was inappropriate. I didn't see it as a sexist comment per se. And I don't think it's beneath any politician to say the same of men. I think the rhetoric gets just as coarse, sometimes more coarse, male to male.
Sam, you know what's interesting about this is that we know that when Donald Trump makes outrageous comments, attacks people in outrageous ways, it tends to fire up his base. They, you know, a lot of people are outraged, they're appalled, but his base loves this sort of thing. So in fact, you know, maybe the Kemp people, the passionate people you're talking about, love it when his campaign speaks out like this.
You know, I frankly think this is inside baseball. I don't think the typical voter looking to go to the polls is paying attention to a quote about Renee Unterman. I do happen to think there should have been an immediate apology once a statement was made. People in the heart of a campaign, when they're not getting enough sleep, say stupid and inappropriate things. The issue is how quickly do you apologize? And I think that's what's missing here.
Mike?
And it speaks to the loss of civility in our society. that I am concerned about, irrespective of whether it's a Republican primary or Democratic primary, at some point I think we need to call time out and move this country back to a place where people can disagree on partisan issues or philosophical issues and not resort to meanness and personal destruction of opponents. And I think that's a sad testament to where we are right now. I won't say it's just Donald Trump. I think he has been the great beneficiary of it because that has been a growing trend over the last 2 to 3 decades. And ultimately, I think it's deteriorating the quality of life in our country as well as the quality of discourse. And there's a difference between winning an election and governing. If you focus all your attention on winning, that makes it much more difficult to govern, even if you do.
I think the mantra here for all the candidates, including the Democrats, is no apologies. I mean, if there's one sort of takeaway line, it's unapologetic. They're all talking about they're the unapologetic progressive, they're the unapologetic conservative.
Correct.
You haven't seen Casey Cagle didn't apologize for what he said in the secret recording. Ryan Mahoney, I doubt, will apologize for his attack on Renee Unterman. So I think they're all taking a playbook from maybe it's Trump, maybe it's just the way that this course is going on in politics now, that any sort of apology is seen as weakness.
All right, let's move on to another issue that really has the potential to have a fairly significant impact on people in Georgia. The Trump administration has decided that they are going to stop $10 billion in subsidy payments to insurance companies that are insuring people with pre-existing conditions. This was money the feds had been giving to those companies because the cost of insuring people with pre-existing conditions is so big. That will affect, according to the reports we're reading, people here in Georgia, the rates perhaps that people are going to pay for insurance on the exchange. Up until this moment, the insurance companies in Georgia had said they expected really to have rather small increases for 2019. Now they're a little bit concerned that that might not be the case. In addition to that, we've also learned that there's going to be another significant reduction in the amount of money for the so-called navigators, the people who work for the feds to help. If you want to get insurance on an exchange, you go to the navigators. They help you figure out what policy and how to do it. It's being reduced. It was $3.5 million 2 years ago. The Trump administration cut it to $1.5 million last year. It's going to be $500,000 this year. All of that said, this is the way in which the Trump administration, Sam, is able to cut away at ACA without having Congress overturn the Obamacare Act.
Look, this is simply the administration's way to destabilize the Affordable Care Act, to push the minority leader in the Senate to agree on a bill on health care. It hurts people in the process, and that's politics. But this is all about trying to get a bill passed. And let's face it, there's gridlock in D.C. as bad as we've ever seen it. This president, instead of saying, okay, I'm just going to get used to it, is going to keep pushing the needle until someone says uncle.
Well, it's politics, but it's also inhumane when you consider the pain and suffering that this will inflict upon innocent men, women, boys, and girls in this state and all across this nation. And it's another example of the obsession that President Trump has in attempting to dismantle almost any and everything that President Obama put in place. I get the politics, but we have to be able to rise above politics on issues of health care so that we can make sure that we are living up to principles that transcend partisanship. And I think this is one, and it's sad. I get it. I'm not a Pollyannish person. I've been in the game a long time, but there are limits. But what we are discovering and what I'm beginning to, and I guess the world is beginning to see, that right now in America, all the barriers are down. And as what Greg was saying, anything goes, not just in what we say, but also in what we do. And that's sad.
So one of the things that's interesting about this, Loretta, is that the Trump administration says that they're cutting the subsidies, the $10 billion nationwide, In response to a federal court ruling that came in, I think, New Mexico, saying that it was an illegal subsidy, which isn't quite what that decision said. The decision actually said that the formula for how much money would be distributed was done improperly. And in fact, the court in New York disagreed entirely that it was, in fact, illegal. So to some extent, the Trump administration is taking advantage of an opportunity to once again whack away at Obamacare.
Right. And you know, to the discussion that's been had thus far, it's in piecemeal fashion, they're eroding the ACA. That what's extremely problematic about this is, one, of course, pre-existing conditions. Republicans and Democrats agree there needs to be a solution for pre-existing conditions. That is a bipartisan, consensus-building platform. The timing of this decision is increasingly problematic because the insurers are already rolling out their plans and getting state approvals for the next year.
Yeah, the deadline's August 22nd,
right,
I believe.
Right, and then enrollment in November. And so, you know, while what they've been doing at the federal level is, on one hand, giving something back and then taking something away. So we saw earlier this summer the Labor Department allowed associations to begin offering group plans again to help deal with the individual market, which was paying, if you're in the individual market and you're a small business owner, you're paying astronomical fees right now, you know, to have insurance. And what we were seeing, unfortunately, in Georgia is, it's fortunate, but the timing of this decision is unfortunate, is that we were seeing some of the carriers that were left the market last year come back into the marketplace.
Well, that's a good point. And Greg, Blue Cross had backed out of Georgia. They couldn't afford to be here, they said. And now, this year, they were talking about coming back in. And they're going to, we don't have any definitive word from them, but this certainly is going to make them think twice. Here's what's interesting, too, though. The Attorney General of Georgia, current Attorney General Chris Carr, has joined a lawsuit challenging the legality of many aspects of Obamacare. We're still waiting for that to play out, Greg. But we're sitting with a former attorney general who also was part of lawsuits of a number of states challenging the legality of Obamacare.
I wonder if you can talk about the inner workings of those decisions.
Sam?
Look, Chief Justice Roberts ruled that it was a tax, and that's how the Affordable Care Act was constitutional, even though no politician in Congress called it a tax. So it was a Hail Mary. So what a group of attorneys general have simply said is, well, we removed the tax. So if the only reason it was constitutional was the tax, if Congress thereafter removes the tax, then it's the emperor with no clothes. I happen to be very nervous, similar to Loretta and similar to Mike, about the fact that people in our country deserve a certain level of health care. And one can talk all the policy and politics they want, but we need people to have a basic level of health care. And our country is sufficiently great that folks, for instance, with pre-existing conditions should have access to that coverage.
Absolutely. And Chief Justice Roberts, who a Republican appointee, cast the deciding vote.
A Trump appointee, of course.
Appointee, right? The U.S. Senate, given the opportunity to vote. With a Republican majority, voted against a major reform. At some point,
Bush, I apologize.
He has so many appointments now. But, you know, at some point, you have to accept this was a bipartisan. It's what Loretta said. These issues are bipartisan issues. You know, where Americans debate it in an honest and forthrightful way. In a democracy, the majority rule, whether it's on the Supreme Court or in the U.S. Senate, let it go. End it. You can't continue in any positive way to try to regurgitate and refight these issues. The thing about what's being proposed now is you have nothing to replace it. See, it would be okay if you had a better option or a better idea. That's not even on the table. It's just undo what Obama did. And there is no other option. It's what Sam is referring
to. Okay, so but to be fair,
okay,
no judge would immediately end the coverage on day one. They would always give the government X period of time to pass substitute legislation.
Correct.
And then the question is whether the grown-ups in D.C. would be able to accomplish that.
And I'm fascinated how the healthcare debate plays into the confirmation of Kavanaugh, the Trump's Supreme Court nominee, because Democrats are seizing on this consensus over pre-existing conditions. And what you're hearing from red state Democrats, Senate Democrats who are facing really tough re-election battles, is some sort of demand that that Kavanaugh embrace some sort of pre-existing condition stability protections in his court rulings. And so that's become a sort of a litmus test for them right now.
Oh, well, let's face it. This is all a joke. I mean, let's face it. The Democrats can think of 10 different reasons why they don't want to vote for Judge Kavanaugh. But I remember the day when advice of consent meant if someone was qualified, you voted for them. So the same comment that Schumer says now is totally antithetical to what he said 5 years ago. So when you have, for instance, the Women's March folks say, we oppose, and they foolishly forgot to put in the name of the nominee, so it says, we oppose XX, that sort of tells you that whoever the president nominated, they were going to oppose. They were always going to say they were racist, they were sexist, they were everything in the world.
Unless it was Merrick Garland.
All right. I do want to spend a couple minutes on that a little bit later in the show. But I want to keep on this subject for one moment. You said, Greg, you're interested in how this will play out in that confirmation of Kavanaugh. I wonder what kind of issue it hands Democrat Stacey Abrams in the gubernatorial race in the fall campaign, and whether or not this might be an issue that she can take advantage of.
If there's one issue that she's pounced on more than anything else, it's expanding Medicaid. To her, that is an economic development incentive. It is a jobs incentive. It is. She's even said that she would reverse the income tax break to fund it, so that the state would have enough money to expand Medicaid. So to her, it's an answer to a lot of the questions about not just healthcare, but also economics and job policy.
All right, we got to get another break in. Before we do, Loretta, I want to give you the last word on this subject.
I hope that we come to some resolution on this really very, very soon. I think with Stacey Abrams, I think that the conversation about expansion of Medicaid is a conversation that was begun under different terms when the ACA was put into place and Georgia had opted not to do that. I think the conversation is different today. And where Greg left it off is, how do you fund that? I think she'll get a lot of pushback on her means or suggestion or recommendation of how she wants to fund it.
Yeah, I mean, that is certainly the case. It is certainly true that the incentives for states to take Medicaid under ACA have rapidly evaporated during the Trump administration. So we'll watch how that plays out. Did you want to say something in answer to that before we go?
I'll save it for after the break.
No, go ahead.
Well, no, part of the strategy, though, if you look at the landscape, that was a front page story. Georgia has, what, $2 billion in reserve? So the real question is how much or any of that windfall should be invested in improving health care for the most underserved people in this city or in this state. So that will be a part of the discussion as well. The good news is we have the windfall. Following up is how will the next governor leverage that windfall to improve the quality of life, whether it's education or health care or economic development. That will be a major platform for debate.
All right. I wanted to get a break. I mean, you just leaned into your mic. Did you have a response to that, Mr. Olens?
You know, those monies are when the state is in dire consequences. We went through that money, and Governor Perdue had a really tough time keeping everything together. I don't want any of the candidates playing with that money. That should be used towards the next recession, should be used for major emergencies.
All right. We got all that in, and we still have a break ahead of us. When we come back, we're going to talk about another issue, and that's, we talk a lot about the two Georgias. That's been talked about for decades in this state, rural as opposed to metro Atlanta. But a new study by a national economic organization talks about the two metro Atlantas. We're going to talk about that after this.
On the next Fresh Air, a former influential leader of the religious right who led militant anti-abortion protests and handed out Ten Commandments plaques to members of Congress and to judges reflects on those actions and tells us why he parted ways with the religious right. We talk with Rob Schenck, author of the new memoir, Costly Grace. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut, Sam Olens, Michael Thurman, Loretta Lepore, Greg Bluestein in the studio with me live today. A couple of quick notes. Remember that a week from Monday, July 23rd, begins the first week in which Political Rewind will be on the air with you 4 days a week. We'll be on Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. We're going to reserve Thursday for a two-way street because, as I've said before, you got to get a little bit of time off from politics. Talk about the arts, talk about culture, entertainment. So, but we do hope you'll join us because you're the reason that we are once again expanding Political Rewind, and we're looking forward to that that week and the beginning. And, of course, that's also, Greg, the week that we have the runoff election, so it's a perfect week to start an additional day of the show.
I'm already looking forward to July 25th.
All right. So the AJC reported the story, but an organization called the Economics Innovation Group released a study of the disparities in zip codes in various areas around the United States. And in Metro Atlanta, the disparities were dramatic, as they were in a number of other states and metro areas as well. The point they make at the very beginning, though, is that since 2000, we've really gone through two recessions. The more severe one, of course, starting in 2007. And they say that when they look at the economic data from zip codes, they find that there are any number of less affluent communities that haven't rebounded at all. And the quote from their president is, distressed communities have been living in a 15-year recession. The highest ranking metro zip code they found, 30024 in Suwannee, and at the bottom, 30315, which we think was is probably South Fulton County. In 2000, Suwannee median income was $87,000. Now it is $102,000. In 30315, it has remained in all of that time virtually unchanged, right around $21,000. So what does this tell us about how entrenched poverty and the inability to bring yourself out of that condition, how powerful it really is, and what do we do about it? Mike Thurman, you live in a county and represent a county that has vast income differences as well.
Yeah, absolutely, and I've lived a life that transcended vast income levels. Let me just be clear. I was born to a sharecropping family among the poorest of poor people in this state. But what was different and is the power of education and economic mobility, which is what the article really spoke to. Children who are born into poor families have almost very little chance of lifting themselves from that poverty.
They never move from that zip code to a more affluent zip code where there may be opportunities waiting
Absolutely.
For them.
Absolutely. The lack of economic mobility, and that is tied to education and other issues such as lack of health care. See, the lack of health care, the issue around Medicaid, has an impact on the ability of people to elevate themselves. Because if you're sick and can't get medical care, it's difficult to go to school, to be successful, or even to hold a job. So it's not just about Obamacare. It's about the opportunities associated with it. Let me say this. This is the issue that will define the 21st century. And much of that lack of mobility, when you look at the Trump supporters, it's also impacting his base. Those are the jobs. As Labor Commissioner Sam mentioned, the recession, I had the unfortunate opportunity to shut down General Motors in Doraville and to shut down Hapeville and spent most of my time in North Georgia, not in inner city Atlanta, but in Dalton and those areas where the textile mill. Those people are facing the same challenges that poor minorities who live in the inner city. So we like to think about poverty or lack of opportunity, and immediately we think about African-Americans or Hispanics.
Inner city neighborhoods.
Inner city. But no, what's driving this anger at the base that Trump is representing right now are some of those same issues, and it's transcendent. And we have to begin to think about how that's going to redefine life in America. I made it out because I had loving parents and I got access to a reasonably good education.
You know, Loretta, Mike's story has always been inspiring. But I guess the question becomes, you work in advising government officials on issues that matter to them. I'm not saying poverty is one of the big ones for you. But the question becomes, what does a Michael Thurmond as CEO of DeKalb County do to address those disparities in his own county?
Well, I think he raised a good point that at the baseline, well, one, what this report points out is that growth, economic vitality does not happen organically. It has to be very purposeful. And so you have to be very intentional about where you try to create jobs and what kind of opportunities you try to bring to different communities. It's going to be different. It's not a one-size-fits-all approach. But I think, he started out by talking about education, and education is the path out for many people, whether you're in an urban environment or in a rural environment. And I think when we're looking at the resources available at the state level, in particular in Georgia, when we look at, there's conversation amongst the gubernatorial candidates about the new revenue that will be generated through the new internet sales tax and so forth, other economic revenue that will be coming into the state. Pre-K is one of the greatest investments we can make in the state, in my opinion. And I think there's universal consensus about that, because when a child gets off to a good start in life, it brings down the cost of everything else. They are situated for a better life of learning and productivity and income. And it's demonstrated. I mean, I've worked with the pre-K community, in full disclosure, and for every investment in pre-K, there is a $7 to $10 return.
Mike, this is not to say you can do it on your own in the county. You need help from outside resources, and they're not always readily available.
First, you protect the school district. My tenure as superintendent of DeKalb County Schools was the same accreditation, right? That's your first investment. If you're not... Whether you have kids in public school or not, whether your kids have already graduated, you can't have this conversation if you're not fully invested in supporting and improving the quality of public education. It's not private versus public. It's just that 90% of the kids are in public.
Sam, you were chairman of a county, Cobb, that had, you had income disparity across zip codes in Cobb, but was it dramatic compared to, say, other counties like a DeKalb, for instance?
Yeah, absolutely. We have similar analogies to, say, a Dunwoody as compared to other parts of DeKalb and Cobb. I mean, we've got East Cobb, West Cobb, and then South Cobb clearly is much poorer. North Cobb has some areas that are poor. I think, look, at the essence of local government, it's education and public safety. And Mike and I have both been there a whole bunch of years. You can do community policing. You can do numerous things to help the community with public safety. This governor has tried numerous times to make significant changes to K-12, and it has been a tough ride. In fact, the prior governor, Governor Perdue, had a decision that I thought lacked legal merit with regard to public education. When the Supreme Court ruled that it was all local, but a whole bunch of the money comes from the state and you have to have licensure from the state, that decision was ridiculous. So having said that, we got to fix the schools. And at the moment, you have too many folks who talk a good talk but aren't willing to do it. When I was running statewide, I will forever remember a forum where the statewides, and I'm sure Mike's been there, they put the local folks first. They put the state at the end. You're half asleep before you go and answer your first question. And there was this education school board race where the discussion was how much lower were these candidates going to reduce the millage rate? Yeah. Because right. The citizenry wanted to pay less taxes. Well, you pay less taxes for the schools that frankly aren't good to begin with. And then let's see what happens to your kids' mobility.
You know, Greg, it seems to me that kind of a theme, an unintentional theme of the show is issues as opposed to, kind of raw politics.
Yeah.
This is not the kind of issue that we might see this from a Stacey Abrams in the campaign, but we're not going to see much. Do you think of a Brian Kemp or a Casey Cagle talking about how to deal with these kinds of disparities?
I mean, look, they have. It's just not a runoff issue. And they all have, you go to their websites, they all have education plans. It's just not the first things out of their mouths at a Republican rally in Carrollton. And remember, it was a 2014 issue. Governor Deal's main thrust in 2014 was overhauling the education funding formula, as boring as that sounds. But he made that a very big part of his reelection campaign and then realized again how, you know, he didn't.
It's a third rail.
It's very hard to do.
I may be totally out of school, and I know there's a rush to the right and the left. I still believe, I don't want to use the term, in a sensible center. I think the votes to be had in November will be the votes of moderate Republicans, Democrats, and others who want solutions as opposed to rhetoric.
All right. We're really short on time, so let me get each of you to respond. Greg just brought up redoing the quality basic education formula, which determines how much money goes to each school district. We still see a great disparity around the state between wealthy communities and poorer communities. Is that something the next governor has absolutely got to take on if we want to start addressing this problem? Just a quick answer from each of you.
I will say that it's been done at least twice in the previous two administrations.
We haven't had a redo of quality basic education.
Exactly. But we have had committees set up under Governor Perdue, i.e. squared.
Right.
Governor Perdue. And then Governor Deal set out to do the same in his first term. And we haven't come to a resolution on that. So I think there are other remedies that need to take place. That may not be the first one. But I won't take up more time.
Sam, do we need a QBE to be redone?
Yes. We also need to tackle greater workforce development post-high school, because we don't have enough folks going to the career academies, colleges, VOTEC, to be able to handle the
All
jobs.
Right. Mike, you get the last word.
Needs-based scholarships, not just hope merit-based scholarships, but we have to bring forward a plan to fund in a broader way. I know we're talking about it. Needs-based scholarships, and to understand the difference between achievement and improvement, growth. Poor kids come to school behind, so you can't really just look at them in terms of whether they are achieving or not. We have to celebrate growth, and that is something that the public education system in Georgia has not embraced
All
enough.
All right, Greg Blushin, it sounds to me like you've gotten at least three ideas for stories to pursue with a gubernatorial candidate.
And debate questions.
That's it. We don't have any more time for today's show, except to say there will be a Republican gubernatorial runoff debate here at GPB live tomorrow night at 7 p.m. It's the debate sponsored by the Atlanta Press Club. And on Friday's show, of course, we will be here. Blushin, you'll be here with me to break down what happened in that debate. We didn't get a chance today to talk about how Democrats, that's what I'm interested in, ought to handle their objections to the nomination of Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Judge Kavanaugh. We'll do that on Friday. So thank you all very much for being with us. Again, we'll see you on Friday for another Political Rewind. Take care.